Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Now it is time for our first weekend theater segment for the new year. And there are tons of shows that are going on. We've got a pretty good winter season on stage in Chicago for some of the big shows that are going on. But also, and I've always said this, that the heart of Chicago's theater scene are some of the smaller shows that are going on that are often 20 times more powerful than the ones that you see on some of the downtown stages. And one example of that would be the world premiere of a show that's called Blue Over You, written by Daniel Noonan, directed by Sarah Whitney. What a coincidence that they would both be here in studio with us at the same time. What an odd turn of events that would be.
Well, we were walking by and we saw you, so we thought we'd just
Let's stop in. Right. Let's stop in and say hi to Uncle Dean. Isn't that nice? Very nice. Nice to see you both. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
To you. So, Daniel, tell me about Blue Over You, because this is a story very close to your own personal life.
Yes. It's a little hard to talk about because it is a mystery. It's a mysterious one-man love story with musical bits. And basically, it's about a high school drama teacher who comes home from work one day and finds his wife missing. So it's his journey trying to find her and woo her back. But it's a comedy in parts, and it also addresses issues that affect millions of Americans, so I don't want to give too much away, but it is a mystery, and it is close to my heart, something that I thought about for years and wanted to write a story on.
Now, this is being presented at the Northminster Presbyterian Church through January the 28th.
Correct.
And, like I was saying, I think these are the kinds of productions that are so often so much more powerful to see in a smaller venue.
An intimate setting.
Intimate setting than a gigantic, arena, which is nice. I'm sure you'd like to be selling tickets to a gigantic arena. But would you? I don't know.
Not for this show, I wouldn't. Okay. It really needs the intimacy that you get with this space. There's 60-some-odd seats. And Michael Joseph Mitchell, who is the one man starring in it, really is doing a tight wire act, basically, without a net. And it's really fun to watch this guy for 90 minutes nonstop. There's two scene changes, which he's in, so he's there for the whole time. And it's just really great to watch him work up close, I think, for this piece. There's, there's other shows we would want to sell in a big broadcast.
You wouldn't want to do 42nd Street in Northminster's basement church, but
it would be kind of cool, though, right?
Well, it would be kind of, although
you'd have to call it 8th Avenue or something.
Right.
It'd have to be a much smaller street than 42nd Street, I think. What's it like, Sarah, to direct a show and stage a show when it's just one performer?
Well, it's interesting you should ask, because I'm now based in St. Louis, and I have been working with a company there called Midnight Company, and the founder of it is a guy who is a master at doing one-man shows, and one critic called him the drug-sniffing dog of one-man shows, the great one-man shows. We just did Title Indeed by Will Eno this past summer, and so I've worked many times with him on a one-man show, and it is different. It's helpful to get a further look at it rather than a standard four-week rehearsal time. We talked with Michael this summer even and said, here's the script, get a look at it. I was back and forth working with him. longer term helps with getting it into a part of your brain that you can really live with it for a while. But Michael's he's like the hardest working guy in show business right now, because he's doing this. He's doing a cabaret act this January as well, while he's doing this.
At Davenport's.
And then he's also, I think, starting rehearsals for a show at Chicago Shakes this month as well. So it's kind of amazing how these actors can have these brains that can compartmentalize.
Somebody needs to, study his brain of how he puts different parts of, his creative world and processes all of it.
It's remarkable. I think he should donate his
brain to science. No, he's very meticulous about how he memorizes. He has to, in his living room, he says he sets his two dogs up on the couch, so they're his audience, and he goes through this whole one-man show. I mean, he walks it, he gets it into his body, because otherwise I think it would be really hard for him to memorize 90 minutes straight. And we would offer to run lines with him, but he would say, no, I really need to physicalize it as I'm rehearsing. So I thought that was really interesting to work with Michael and find that out about him.
Very interesting that he'd rather rehearse with dogs than humans.
It is. I don't know what that says about me, but yes, his
dogs are unconditional love for
right.
a dog.
That's right.
They're
right there for him.
They're right there. If you can get them to pay attention for that long, that would be great. The actors that I've talked to have told me that it's more difficult doing a one-person show than working with a big, giant cast, because you have time to think a little bit during more conventional type shows where you have other castmates and you're reacting to things, as opposed to you are everything in the show. You're every character. You're every bit of scenery. You're everything in these one-person productions.
It's true. He has no one to play off of except the audience. He does speak to them directly. It's a direct address. And his flock of guardian angels are his other playing partner. And that fascinates me, too, because if you are in the middle of this show and you need to take a breather, how do you do that? And sometimes we work those in so that he has a moment that he can just even take a drink, take a sip, and have that split second where he can stop for a moment. But yes, I have such admiration of actors, but specifically ones that are willing to tackle a one-man show. He did one 10 years ago. Jinx, you owe me a Coke.
Yes.
I have not heard that since I was 12 years old.
There you go. Well,
that's fantastic.
Dan and I are like best buddies. but so, and he was like, this is going to be a real challenge 10 years later to take this on. But he's also the one, this is a baby that has only been gestating for
9 years.
Wow. So, and Michael was the first actor that we thought of when we said, we just need somebody to read this to us. So he has been in touch with the script over the years as well. And I think it's in a part of him that is deeper than something he would have just seen recently.
Yeah, if we did make it clear before, the Michael that they're referring to is Michael Joseph Mitchell, who stars in the show Blue Over You. We'll talk more with its director and playwright in just a moment. It's playing, by the way, through January the 28th at Northminster Presbyterian Church in Evanston. In studio with us this morning is Sarah Whitney and Daniel Noonan. They are the director and playwright of the world premiere of the production of Blue Over You, which is in Chicago pretty much for the month of January. Daniel, talk to me a little bit about how you came up with all this. I know it's difficult to talk about because you don't want to give things away, but as best you can, just how you even come up with this. You mentioned that, what a process this was. How many years?
I think I finished the first draft in 2008.
Wow.
So that's
a process.
That's 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was, most things that I write are motivated by things that happen to me in my personal life or with my family. And I don't write the exact story, but it's the impetus for me to write a broader story. So I had something I wanted to write about, and I also knew I wanted it to be a love story. So Francis is completely despondent that his wife is missing, and he really wants to find her and bring her back. And I just thought this would be kind of an interesting twist with the mystery and the love story together. But it does come from somewhere in my personal life. But like I said, I'll talk about that once the show closes.
All right, let's make a date to come back.
Yeah, sounds good.
When people can no longer see the show.
Right.
To explain it all. Like, what are the kinds of things in the past that have been part of your own life that you've turned, you know, that it clicked a creative spark that turned into something else?
Sure. Well, Sarah and I worked on a show together called Out Among the Dragons that was also produced at Northminster in 2005. And that speaks to my experience. I have hemophilia, and as a result, I also have HIV. So I grew up with that. I became HIV positive when I was 13. And I went through the whole roller coaster experience of the AIDS epidemic in the United States in the 80s and 90s and still today. And so I wanted to write about three people who had contracted the virus in three different ways and what that means and how, unfortunately, there's a big stigma attached to some people depending on how they acquire the virus. And the hemophiliac who's always thought of as the innocent victim. So that was a very personal story, which I turned into a comedy, believe it or not. And it was three people who met in an infectious disease clinic and became friends and really started to work with each other to help them realize their goals and dreams. And this was before The Cocktail came out in 1994.
I was going to ask you what year that was, because there was a time when there was nothing funny about talking about HIV whatsoever.
Right.
You know, but the fact that you wrote it makes it different, and the fact that the whole way, you know, that we battle HIV now and its consequences, 100% different now.
Yes.
Makes a big difference, in all of that.
Right, right. And I chose, it was produced in 2005, but the play is set in 1994 because that's when The Cocktail first came out. It was right when things changed. But what I wanted to, one of the issues I wanted to address in the play is that although there were life-saving drugs, the stigma was still there, and people couldn't escape that. And, yeah, I think the stigma is one of the biggest problems with the whole AIDS epidemic. People are afraid to go get tested because they don't want to have to explain to anybody it's
right
why they have it.
Right, right, right. Was that difficult for you in dealing with that personally?
The stigma?
Yeah.
Well, a little bit at first, yes. I mean, I had roommates in college who were nervous to be living with me because I was HIV positive. This was in the late 80s, and people weren't as informed as you would like them to be. So there was that. But overall, I would say I was kind of a poster child, an innocent victim. This is why we should care.
Because you're hemophiliac.
Right, yeah. Right. Which is very sad in my opinion, but in many ways I was viewed as someone who was innocent. And so, you know, we were all in it together, though, and thank God they finally came up with a cocktail.
Yeah, yeah. And good that it opened up a conversation about it.
Yes.
Especially back then, opened up a conversation about it, and that you were able to write something that wasn't dire and tragic and, you know, that was lighthearted about the whole thing, that made it easier for people to talk about the subject. I remember talking about AIDS and HIV on the radio.
Sure.
Back then, and how controversial it was to even bring it up.
Right.
Back then, people freaked out at the idea of even bringing something up over the public airwaves that might save their lives.
Right, right.
The best part about Dan and his writing is that he takes subjects that could be really heavy and heady and maybe difficult to deal with, and he starts out by cracking you open with the comedy. And so that once you're comfortable enough with these characters and can laugh at the situations, then he's able to bring in the point that he needs to make. And a lot of times it has to do with compassion, and that's something I love about working with Dan. He opens me up to being more compassionate. But I just love how his style is crack him open with some comedy, and then you've got him so you can talk.
Is that an intentional technique where you're, I'll do this to crack him open with the comedy and then make my point, or
no,
does it
I wouldn't
just sort of evolve?
It's just part of my writing, yeah. I think, and being a person living with multiple chronic health conditions, I was very fortunate. My mother was loving and funny and kind, and she always taught me to find the humor in the situation, and that really translated into my writing. So it's hard for me to not see often the absurdity and humor in a lot of situations. And that was true growing up with HIV. I mean, it was not easy, but there were things that were kind of absurd and funny about it, and that eventually made its way into my writing.
Not something that you hear people say who grew up, especially from age 13.
Right.
At the time when HIV was so serious, to be able to find absurdity humor in the whole thing is rather remarkable.
I mean, I was probably 19 or 20, and I was having a doctor's visit, and there was a resident who came in, and we were just talking about where my T cells were and how I was doing, and he drew a little bar chart, and he drew my line off the chart. He's like, well, people lose maybe 50 to 100 T cells a year, and you're here, so in 4 years, you could be in real trouble. He didn't say that, but he just drew my line off the chart. And I said, how can you do that to a patient? Yeah. Draw their line off the chart. I said, this is crazy.
Yeah, nobody wants to see that.
No. Yeah. Unfortunately, that didn't happen to me, but he was trying his best. He thought he was enlightening me to my situation, yeah. But...
Dan is a walking miracle, and one of the reasons why we decided to risk doing this show is because he's taught me, you know, life is too short. You know, if you've got a good play and you want people to see it, put it on. He's sort of informed me of his story throughout his life, and I'm always impressed with how he always looks on the sunny side and finds the jokes, and also says, now is the time, because we're not guaranteed. Yeah.
What a great lesson, to be learned, not just in this production, but for life in general, that people are so cautious about things in fear of what might happen if it fails. But even sadder, what would happen if you never even try?
Yes.
And then fail, you know, because you also may succeed at the same time. Good for you. This is an inspiring story today. This is a very inspiring theater segment today.
Oh, hey. Glad it is.
Perfect for the first segment of the new year today to start off on a note like this. The world premiere of Blue Over You just happened the other day, and it will play until the 28th of January at the Northminster Presbyterian Church, which is 2515 Central Park Avenue in Evanston. You can get tickets at blueoveryou.com. And thank you both for coming in. Sarah Whitney, the director, and Daniel Noonan, the very inspiring playwright.
Thanks, Dean.
Joining
Thanks so
us
much,
this
Dean.
Morning. Happy New Year to you both.